So this is day three of our five-day retreat, and we're working through the four foundations of mindfulness. We're working through the body sensations. Within sensations, we folded emotions. And today we're going to start to examine the mind. And you may feel that, you know, it's kind of strange that today we're examining the mind, because isn't that what we've been doing for the last 2.5 days, right? We've been watching the mind, this little monkey in our head that's drunk and been stung by a bee, right? And perhaps you've been playing with this monkey, perhaps you've been trying to wrestle it down, perhaps you've been sort of saying, fine, I give up, go do what you want, right? But there's a slightly different perspective we're going to take now, is in looking at exactly what is this that we call the mind, and what role does it play in our life? Right? You might have seen, you know, these posters on the internet. They're called memes, right? This little poster, this beautiful, it's usually on a white background, and there's these, you know, little trees in the distance, and there's this person walking their dog. And the person's got the balloon over their head, and the balloon is full of all kinds of things, right? The cell phone and the you know, fax machine and, you know, papers and people and all kinds of things. And this is supposed to represent us as we're walking around with our mind full of things, right? And the dog, of course, has the balloon of the dog is basically a representation of the landscape, right? That's got exactly the same. So the idea there is that, you know, the dog's mind is mindful. It's just seeing what's there. And it's just available to what's there. And for the most part, there's, you know, it's an accurate representation. However, for those of you who own dogs or cats, you recognize, you know, that they're not just kind of wandering through the landscape, appreciating the trees and, you know, sniffing the flowers, and, you know, they're seeking things out. I mean, our dogs are you know, they're 91 pounds each, and they think they only weigh 2 pounds, and, you know, once they get to the end of that leash, there's no question that they're after something, right? On our farm, we live on a farm, and so we have these little electric collars, and it doesn't hurt the dog, I'm told. I tried it on myself, and it actually does hurt. I wanted to know if it was working. I thought, is this really good? Ah, yes, it works. So, have you tried it on yourself? Two shrinks. You cannot have two shrinks in the house, and we're not experimenting with electrodes somehow, you know? I figure if I start getting depressed, I'm just going to attach it to my head and walk around. So anyway, dogs. So we figure, okay, there's a signal, there's a little sound signal that tells the dog it's at the edge of its, you know, it's at its rumble strip. If you start going further, you're going to get shocked. One of them learned very quickly that this was not what he wanted to do. So even if he doesn't wear the collar, he just doesn't go past where that invisible fence is. And the other one, however, it just depends on what's on the other side, right? And so, you know, if there's a cat, if the cat is out and the cat's on the other side, gone, straight through, right? He doesn't even feel the shock. He's also got a lot of thick fur, so I don't quite know what's going on. But the interesting thing is, the dog's supposed to be afraid when they're coming back, because they're supposed to be calmer when they're coming back. You know, when, you know, they're happy, they've chased down the squirrel or whatever, and they're coming back. And that's when they're also supposed to be very attentive to the shock. Well, with cause, there's no question about it. Oh, Mom, look what I found. I found a skunk. Woo-hoo! And it comes right through the fence again. And, you know, so it really alerts me to the fact that it's not the pain that creates the aversion, right? It is to some degree, but it's also the quality of mind that I have at the time. If I'm having a really good time, I'm probably not going to notice that I've twisted my ankle, right? But if I'm concerned and anxious and tentative, I'm going to be more alert to certain things. So this is the role of the mind, is that it has a quality within it that allows us to put up with really tough stuff. But also, it allows us to ignore really tough stuff because we're preoccupied with what we're doing. Okay. The other part about dogs and that meme is that, you know, when Kaz chases down the skunk or he chases down the squirrel, he doesn't catch it, obviously, because he's just not that smart and not that fast. He doesn't come home and kind of lie around and feel like his worth has been challenged. You know, he doesn't sort of look at me and go, I don't know what I'm going to do. I really thought I was a good dog. I really thought, you know, I don't, there must have been something wrong with the squirrel. I mean, they obviously set a project with that squirrel that was outside my ability to fare. There's, you know, there's got to be politics involved in this, right? I don't get it. I mean, that skunk, really, that was a totally unfair thing to spray me. And now you're mad at me? And now I'm not allowed on the sofa? My life has no meaning. I mean, I don't know about your dogs, but my dogs don't do that. They kind of come in and go, hi, Mom, I smell pretty. I don't understand. What do you mean I can't get on the sofa? I'm getting on the sofa. I'm 91 pounds. You can't do anything about this. Right? So, to some degree, it's the quality of mind and it's the attitude that we bring to it, right? When I go out to get the perfect photographic shot and I don't get it, I kind of walk away feeling a little dejected, right? I'd like to be like my dog who just kind of shakes it off and goes, well, there's another squirrel, off I go, right? So all of this to say that we spend so much of our time, not just in our head, but we spend so much time in our forebrain. You know, just this little piece in you. I don't know about how big yours is, but mine's probably about 1 cubic inch, right there. And that's where we kind of live. We create our world there. We have visions of ourselves. We create images of who we think we are, who I think you are, you know, what I think is happening, how I think the world is functioning, how it functions. The difficulty, and there's nothing wrong with that, I mean, we do have to have these mental maps. The difficulty is that we filter everything based, you know, as we've been repeating over and over again, like a broken record, we are a threat detection system. So we're going to create a world that is in fact based on that threat detection system. We're going to always be surveying the world to see how it fits our view. And those little mini captures of how the world fits our view are what we call mental formations. Some terms are like mental fabrications. I don't like that because it sounds like we're lying or making things up, but we're really not. We're just trying to make sense of the world. So we collect these little data packages, and these data packages are things that help us navigate the world. If I see the world as fundamentally safe and friendly, then I'm going to approach people and objects and things in a fundamentally trusting way. If I see the world, or I've been trained to see the world as a fundamentally unsafe place, then I'm going to approach things and people with a tentativeness. I'm going to be hypersensitive to things that might hurt me, either emotionally or physically. I'm going to have trouble with intimacy because, you know, intimacy may mean having been hurt at one point, right? And it doesn't have to be physical. It can be emotional as well. While many people have gone through, you know, physical abuse or sexual abuse in their childhood years or in their life, many of us have also gone through what we call emotional abuse as well. Not because we had parents who were awful and terrible or friends or relatives, but because they suffer too. That's not to diminish what was done, but to also understand that every single human being comes from a threat response system, or comes with a threat response system. And many of us may have been very unskillful in how we utilized that, how we drew from that. Okay. And many of our actions may have been unwholesome. Unwholesome meaning it didn't have a positive outcome. Many of our actions may have been very wholesome. In other words, they had a positive outcome. Now, I talked yesterday about intention and outcome, right? My intention is to be kind to you, and I act in a way that I believe is kind, and you experience it as kindness. Then bingo, we've got a we've got the little trivariate thing that's happened that says, oh, this congruence here. So my action then is defined as wholesome. It's only defined by the outcome. It's not defined by the intention. Right? So my intention is to hurt you and you feel hurt, then that's an unwholesome outcome because it's not geared, there's another layer, it's not geared to establishing a healthy relationship. Okay. So, and I'll expand on that a little bit in a bit. According to my script, I'm expanding on it now. So, needing sleep, for example, when we're tired, sleep is a wholesome act, right? If I'm tired, I sleep. If I sleep, the Dalai Lama said, was asked at one point, what was the best form of meditation? And he said, 7 hours sleep. And you know, it's true. As you may have noticed, Frank and I are kind of spelling each other off in the morning, so at least one of us gets to sleep in a little bit. And I must admit, I really enjoyed that chance to just sleep until I woke up, as opposed to sleep until the alarm went off. Right? However, if I'm afraid of being tired, and so I try to bank my sleep by oversleeping, that may not be skillful. And that may not have wholesome outcomes. Because often, because I'm afraid of a particular outcome, I start to do things that I think are going to be healthy, but may not be healthy. So oversleeping is a tendency we all have when we're feeling anxious, or when we're feeling like we don't really want to face the world, or we're afraid that, you know, if I don't get 10 hours sleep today, I'm not going to be able to function tomorrow. Well, I don't know that. Sleep's a very touchy thing around that, around generating energy. Right? But there's my filter, isn't it? I'm afraid of being tired. So someone who lives with fibromyalgia, you know, that initial sense of feeling tired is a huge trigger. Right? It makes me sit up and go, I'm not going to be able to get through this. I got to do something right now. Right? But of course, what have I done? I've braced against it. Which means, of course, I'm going to be more tired because, not because I truly am tired when I first started, but because now I'm creating that fatigue by bracing against it. Okay. So it's really important to see that, you know, we use these filters because we're just trying to survive. Every one of us. I love the story of, you know, if you're walking down a forest path and you see a shape, immediately your brain is going to go, snake! Turn around, go home, right? Because it's safer to think it's a snake than to explore to see if it's a stick. Because what if I think it's a stick but it's really a snake? Then I made a mistake and if I get bitten, I'll probably die, right? That won't happen here in Ontario unless you're up in Georgian Bay. But the safety part says it's much better to assume it's a snake even if it's a stick. Because to be wrong could mean something dangerous. Right. If you're right, that's great. I've avoided being bitten. But if I'm wrong and I think it's a stick when it's a snake, then I'm taking a risk. Right. So over our lifetime, I worked out the percentages. If we go based on our threat response system without actually staying calm and seeing the data for what it is, 25% is only 25% of the time will we assume that it's safe. That's a whole lot of the world that we're actually avoiding when you think about it, right? We're avoiding 75% of the world in all of our experiences. The difficulty is that when we're upregulated, we don't take in information in a way that's what we call clean data. The data is always tinged with a need to lower the risk to the lowest possible factor. Which is why anxiety becomes so evocative, or depression, or any of the other, you know, a physical illness is so evocative, because we see it as a threat, and we respond as if the threat has already unfolded. I can't wait to figure out how this threat is going to unfold, because the need to survive is too high. So I'm going to act in impulsive ways. Right? And one of the most impulsive ways is that, first of all, I'm going to deny that it's happening. So I'll just keep going, right? Or I'll engage in all kinds of things that are basically magical thinking. Let's throw this solution to it. Let's throw that solution to it. You know, let's go do this. Let's go do that. One of the phenomena we notice when people come into mindfulness is that, you know, the initial physiological response to meditating is relaxation. Right? Herbert Benson figured this out decades long before mindfulness came on the scene. And so the relaxation response, of course, is contrary to feeling tense. So we fall in love with the relaxation response. So after a while, after people, and this is a warning, this is a cautionary note, after you've gone to your first, you know, weekend retreat, then you start getting hungry for, you know, I felt so good at the end of that retreat, I'll do a 5-day retreat. I felt so good at the end of that, I'll do a 10-day retreat. These 10-day retreats are awesome. I'm going to go to a 10-day retreat every month, right? And it has happened. We've watched some of the people who come through our teacher training program. They don't last long in our program. Who get addicted to retreats. Because, you know, it's a high. After a little while, you start to feel that high of coming back and bringing your system down and soothing and calming, that now it becomes, you need that hit. Right? And then we start thinking, oh, well, my meditation wasn't very good because I didn't get that hit. My meditation was, you know, really good because I got that hit. Right? It's subtle. So we have to be careful. I'm not saying don't go to a 10-day retreat every month. But look at your intention. What, you know, what's happening here? What is the mind creating that becomes a mental formation that says, I've got to have a hit? Right? And how often have people said to us, my mindfulness isn't working anymore? Well, no, your mindfulness is always working. It's just, what are you mindful of? You can be mindful of things that are unhealthy. Right? So all of that to say that what we're aiming for in this practice is to look at to watch how our mind creates these situations of craving, of greed, of wanting more, all because all of us come from a model of a fear of deprivation. We feel that we won't get what it is that we really need. So I have this collection of oil lamps. For some reason, at some point, and I'm blaming Frank for this, he introduced me to the idea of oil lamps when we first met. And I thought that was the most amazing thing. I'd never really seen an oil lamp. So we've got a house full of oil lamps, some of which are quite ugly. And some of which are really, you know, they're like little kitsch things, right? Some of which are quite valuable and beautiful. But I kind of look back and I think, I wonder why I thought having every oil lamp I ever saw in every antique store we ever went to was going to make me happy. I mean, in the moment it did, right? And now I've got all these oil lamps I don't know what to do with, and I don't have the room in the house for them. And I have to learn how to let go. But somewhere in my mind, that mental formation of greed kind of took hold and went, I need to soothe my anxiety of not having enough. And the way to soothe it is to buy one more oil lamp. So if you guys want some oil lamps, let me know. Right? Happy to let them go. The soothing piece is so important. Paul Gilbert, and I think Paul Gilbert's probably got the most powerful compassion training program. If you get to take any kind of a training program, I would recommend that one. And also you get to travel to interesting places like Australia and the UK to do the training, which is great. I think it complements self-compassion really well, the mindful self-compassion. Paul talks about safeness. Because remember, we don't feel safe, right? This threat detection system's constantly going. I'm looking around the room right now, and whether I know it or not, I'm appraising whether or not I'm actually hitting the target, that sweet spot of a dog. I'm looking at your faces. Don't get anxious. I'm looking at your faces. I'm looking for, oh, thank you. Wow, this, my safeness just went up, right? Yeah, see, I'm looking for that feedback. If you're all quiet and, you know, sitting there like this and going, oh, what's she talking about? Then my safeness level's going to go down, right? So we're coming from that, oh, my safety level. So safety is different from safeness. Safety is my sense of, can I continue to stay here and survive? Okay. Safeness is that internal process that we acquire when we were infants, that connection with a loved one, with our primary caregiver, that soothing of being held and swaddled and cuddled, right? In our family, we're a very cuddly family. You know, so I mean, our daughter grew up always being, you know, hugged and sat. You know, she would sit on our laps, and we would read stories, and a lot of soothing, a lot of comforting, right? Although when you talk to her, you listen to her, I wonder what family she grew up in, but that's a whole different story, right? I know. Do you know what family she grew up in?
I wasn't there.
Yeah, I know. The family I was in was not the family she was in, so I have no idea. But, you know, she's got a phenomenal self-soothing system. So whoever her parents were, they did a really good job. And I look at our granddaughter, and I think, oh, my gosh, my heart just swelled. She's almost five. She's just starting school. And the first thing that came back was the note from the teacher that said, she has wonderful self-soothing capacities. Mm. I can die now. Isn't that beautiful, though? She has self-soothing capacities. You cannot be a better parent than that, right? Well, okay, this is all about me, right? So, you know. But what an amazing little kid at 4 3/4, you know? And then I watch her in the home, and it's really good. You know, the parent, one of her parents would say, no, you can't do that. I'd like you to turn off the TV. I'd like you to go and play with your toys. But I turn off the TV. I'd like you to go and play with your toys. Oh, okay. There's no edge of, you know, I'm not getting what I need. I'm going to pound on the floor or whatever. She does have her moments. Oh, no question about that. Luckily, we've been spared it. I find cookies really help to spare that. But that's what we may or may not have gotten from our own parents. Again, not because they were horrible people, but because this was not something that may have been culturally or generationally done. You know, we've had theories like let them cry it out, or, you know, tell them that you'll give them something to really to cry about if they're crying. You know, stuff like that. There's been all kinds of parenting styles and concepts that haven't been helpful. So our job right now is to create that internal sense of safeness for ourselves. Right? And it's hard. It's really hard. Because if you've never had an experiential model of being soothed, of being comforted, of being swaddled, that's why we swaddle babies. We kind of, not too tightly, we pressure the body so that the vagal system is activated. And that's the soothing system. That's why hugs are so wonderful. Although I just read a study that said there's scientific evidence for why some people don't like to be hugged. I don't believe it, but I have to respect boundaries. But self-hugs, the way in which we hold ourselves, can create that sense of internal safeness. So it's really crucial for us to see that, yes, we have this threat response system, but we can also build. Remember we talked about encouraging the positive, encouraging the healthy aspects of ourselves? So there are these unhealthy aspects, unwholesome skills that we have, but there are also wholesome aspects of ourselves. And that sense of safeness, that release of oxytocin, that sense of calming, you can access that through meditation. But we also have to access that through our own internal work. Right? The world is a scary place. You know, I don't want to be naive about that. And many of you in here have seen scarier parts of the world than I will ever see. And, you know, there is no question that you've committed your lives to protecting the world, protecting us from ourselves, right? So I'm not diminishing that. What I am also saying is that in our mental formations, we can't only believe that the world is only a terrible place. We have to start to believe that the world can be a comforting place, that it can be a sense of connection that's safe. But to do that, we have to have an internal sense of safeness. I have to know that I can soothe myself when nothing else is available for me, or whether anything is available for me or not. Right? Otherwise, it becomes a reliance on the world needing to be safe so that I can feel safe. We call that wanting to cover the world with leather so I don't have to wear shoes. Right? You know? And I mean, you know, you might have seen this, you know, you might have seen this in the sense of people who really need you to be a certain way so that they're not triggered. Or people who need you to only treat them a certain way so that you feel calm. You can't rely on that because they're coming from their own delusional state too, right? They're coming from their own illusions about how this world should work. So when we have that internal sense of safeness, the mental formations don't have as much of a grip on us. Right? I don't need you to be good so that I can be good. Or so I can feel safe. I don't need you to approve of me so that I can continue to do my work. It'd be nice, you know, I appreciate it, but I can't hook my worth on that. So it's about self, you know, in cognitive therapy we talk about our relationship to self, others, and the world. And mental formations really create our own sense of self, they create how we view ourselves. Mental formations also create how we view others. My mom developed dementia about 3 years after my dad, now I think it was right at his funeral, now that I think about it. You know, it was really quite sad to see her start to deteriorate as soon as he died. But she'd gone through a fairly bad time caring for him. When it was really clear that she couldn't live on her own anymore, I managed to have her transferred to Ottawa to a home just down the road from our place. Mom and I had a horrible relationship, and it was never resolved when she was still compos mentis, right? And she had a very, very painful, very challenging life. I have no idea what happened to her. I can suspect, but it was clear there was some significant trauma in her life. And, you know, we didn't know about traumatic reactions, and we didn't know about, you know, the type of emotional dysregulation that can happen and things like that. She was also, to cope with all of that, she was also an alcoholic. So it was very, very sad. And so I had a very challenging relationship with her. I had a very toxic relationship with her, which also created in me the capacity to have toxic relationships with other people. I'm very good at having toxic relationships with people. I am working on it. I really am. Right?
Yes.
Thank you. Notice how I needed him to approve of me. So the story goes, it's a beautiful story. I would go to see Mom. Mom loved Frank. Frank was the last person she forgot. She forgot all of us, which was kind of a relief. So he could go visit her and I didn't have to go. But so we would take her out every Sunday for lunch to her favorite Indian restaurant, and they were wonderful there. They, you know, they treated her like royalty, and because she believed she was. And so I showed up one day on a Saturday and I brought her some new clothes. And, you know, and I took away her old clothes and I brought her some new clothes. And she loved dressing up, so every month I would buy her something new. And, you know, and then I realized I didn't have to buy something new. I could just bring back the other week and then she would never know. So anyway, so I show up with these clothes, and she's just, every time she's home, she'd rail at me what a horrible daughter I was, and just the words that she would use to describe me, and, you know, I was at this, and I was, and they were usually sort of sexually connotated. It was very painful to listen to. But I kind of, you know, put on a thick skin and went, okay, this is the armor I have to wear when I go in. And so I put all the clothes in. I said, you know, Mom, I brought you some new clothes. And go, right, you're this, you're that, you're the other. You're just like your father. And he was this and he was that. It was all very painful. And so I left and, you know, feeling really, always feeling really torn apart. And the next day we would go to pick her up to go for lunch. And this was, you know, this was my commitment. This was what we would do. So I went upstairs to get her. And she looked at me and she beamed. And she said, I'm so happy to see you. Honey, I'm so, so happy to see you. And I thought, okay. Like my spidey senses are going. Like, all right, what's, like, I know she's in a dementia, very severe dementia state. But my own mental formations were, yeah, this is the mom that's about to get you close so she can nail you, right? So my own mental formations came up, you know, unsafe, untrustworthy. So she said, come and sit beside me. Okay. So I, you know, I said, yeah, that's great. She goes, she took my hand. She goes, thank you so much for the clothes you brought yesterday. I love them. Oh, okay, maybe there's a bit of reality grounding here. And she says, you know, I just love it when you come and you visit to take me out. Not like my daughter, who's just an awful human being. And I thought, oh my gosh, she's forgotten me. Isn't that awesome? Really? Once her mental formations about who I was to her in that relationship were gone, for the next 3 years, I had the mom I felt I deserved. Right? Isn't that awesome? I mean, really, she had to let go of who she thought I was. All of it. All of it. We can't get invested in, but I'm her daughter. I want her to remember me as her daughter. I don't want her to remember me as the daughter she thinks I am. I really don't, because that daughter, I don't know who the heck she is, but someone ought to call CAS on her, you know? Once she forgot, once that mental formation of who I was to her was erased, we could have a relationship that was exactly what I needed and exactly what she needed. Right? She needed a daughter who wasn't constantly on guard around her, constantly mouthing words that she didn't believe in. You know, oh, Mom, I love you. Well, no, I don't. I didn't. You know, that mom, I couldn't love. Right? But the mom that she became for the 3 years that we had left, and we didn't know at the time it would be 3 years, but we had three wonderful years. Every time I walked in, it was, oh, and you brought Frank. You're so wonderful. And you brought Frank. And we could laugh and we could joke and we'd take selfies and, you know, and we'd go for walks and we'd go to this restaurant. And we couldn't go to a restaurant anymore after a while because she would become too agitated. But we would drive there to get takeout. We'd go back to our house and we'd have the takeout. So she still had the familiarity of the food, right? It was so rich. And, you know, in some sense, I hope that in many ways when we have difficult relationships, that somehow in our brain the chemistry would allow us to erase those mental formations of who we think the other person is. Now, I want to be very careful here. This was only really also possible for me because she was no longer a physical or emotional threat. Okay, that's a really key piece in this, right? If she had still been a physical and emotional threat, that wouldn't have worked. She could have forgotten me, but still had the capacity to push all my buttons. Then the work is harder for me to disconnect those buttons. And when it comes to parental relationships, I don't know that we can ever disconnect those buttons because they're hardwired. I can disconnect a button that's related to what someone thinks of me, whom I just have a peripheral relationship with. The deeper the intimacy, the harder it is to unwire that and rewire it. Right? So I want to be careful that I'm not, you know, oversimplifying the situation. But part of that is learning that I will always need her approval. Both my parents are gone. I will always need their approval. But this is not the only approval that I'm willing to accept. I will take surrogate approvals, right? And it's important to do that. That's how I dismantle my mental formations about what I need. You know. It's not always perfect. You know, I still flip back and forth to being, you know, cranky and demanding. And yes, you're driving me to the train station. You know, things like that. Right. Good. It was a little, what, you're not driving me to the train station. When I'm anxious and I'm upregulated, it's really hard to spot those mental formations. When I'm afraid of rejection, it's very hard. So that's where the breathing, that's where the self-compassion comes in. That's where the ability to soothe ourselves. You know, we worked on the self-compassion break yesterday as part of our meditation. The first part is the soothing, or the second part is the soothing part. The common humanity piece is a soothing process. Of course I'm going to feel this way. Of course it's going to hurt, right? So when I have the capacity through touch, through appropriate self-touch, and as an aside, I want to also mention that touch may not be the way in which you feel soothed. Touch may have all kinds of other triggers or evoke other sense emotions that may lead to not feeling safe. But find something that you do find soothing. I have a favorite scarf which I left at a retreat center that I love wearing when I'm meditating because it gives me a sense of feeling safe. It's a ratty old scarf and it's wonderful, but a shawl is wonderful, but for me it has that evocation of feeling safe. Right? So it can be an object. You know, it can be mala beads, it can be anything. It should be tactile, but it allows us to connect and feel like we can bring our system down so we're more able to make skillful decisions. Okay. So mental formations really shape our relationships, but we can also undo our mental formations, okay, to have healthier relationships. The challenge is when we try to undo our mental formations about ourselves. Right? So we dealt with others. Our mental formations with ourselves are kind of like, they tend to be harsh. I mean, we all have an inner critic. They tend to be very harsh. They tend to be like a war that we have with ourselves. And many of us have this ongoing internal war with ourselves. And we can't constantly be embattled and feel healthy. We need to surrender at some point. Or we need to find a way to kind of have a detente or, you know, a peace treaty with ourselves. Thich Nhat Hanh really advises that, you know, we write a peace treaty with ourselves. I love that idea. You know, I love that. It's along with the idea of writing a letter to my inner critic and thanking them for trying to help and gently pointing out that they're really not helping. Right? Acknowledging that, yes, I know you want me to feel safe, but you know the way you're going about it isn't helping. I was leading a group one evening. We used to have an ongoing alumni group, and because of our travels and stuff, we haven't been able to pick it up again. But I was talking about the inner critic, and you know, the standard thing is, you know, what do you say to yourself when you've done something that you're, you know, that makes you feel that, you know, that you don't feel you did well, or that, you know, you've been critical with yourself about. And how do you talk to yourself? And most people would say, well, you know, I'm pretty harsh with myself. You know, and I go like, okay, come on, you know, quit being such a loser, get on with it. And so the standard intervention I'm giving away, those of you doing the mindful self-compassion training, I'm giving away a little bit of the secrets here. So the next question you ask is, well, if this was a friend who was having this difficulty, what would you say? And, you know, most people would say, I would, you know, tell my friend to, you know, that it's okay, they can try again. So I'd be supportive. The words would be kind. They would be generous. They would be soothing. So someone in the room, so I asked this question. I said, you know, what do you say to yourself when you feel you failed yourself? And this person in the room said, well, I just tell myself to suck it up and get on with it. Okay, so they're keeping to script. Okay? And I said, oh, all right. So, you know, so there's a segue to the next question. So what would you say if this was a friend who was going through this? And she looked at me kind of perplexed. And kind of went, I'd tell them to suck it up. And I thought, oh, yeah, we're off script here. What do I do? You know, you don't expect that. I mean, my patients are very compliant. I can lead them by the nose straight to the right answer, right? So we're totally off the therapeutic script here. So I'm kind of thinking, okay, what do I do? What do I say? I got to save this, right? Because this is not where we're supposed to go. And then it hit me. And I said, what would you say to your friend that they would hear? Uh-huh. Right? Because I can yell at you to calm down. I doubt you'll calm down. I can tell you to stop being a loser. I doubt you'll feel better. You won't hear, most of us don't hear things that upregulate us. So what can I say to myself that I would actually hear? That won't trigger this internal debate. Because I don't know about you, but I've never won a debate with myself. Right? I've never won an argument I got into with myself. I only end up doing what my threat detector tells me to do if I get into that situation. So it's really crucial to look at my relationship to myself may contain that mental formation that I'm only good if I've been beaten into it. It speaks to a trust in our own selves. Right? Can I trust myself to still be good even though I haven't beaten myself into it? Can I trust my accomplishments, the carrots, to not need to become a stick so that I can keep going? Because we often use our accomplishments as sticks rather than as the carrot that they are. The carrot is supposed to be nourishing, you know? But we take that carrot and we beat ourselves into the next hurdle so that we'll get going and keep going. So these are the mental formations that show up because fundamentally we want to belong, we want to be part of a community. We're afraid that we'll be isolated and kicked out if we don't perform. And we're afraid that we won't survive unless we do things in a way that keeps us hyper alert all the time. And for many of us, our self-identity is tied up with what we do. It's tied up with the community that we're in. If I'm holding to my mental formation, I am a psychologist, and one day, you know, something happens and I'm not able to speak, or, you know, I'm not able to think, although that may already be happening, you know. I mean, if I have a disease or a disorder that prevents me from doing my work, my self-identity would be impacted, there's no question about that. But can I also have a sense that I'm not only defined as being a psychologist, that I'm defined by so many other ways? You know, and as I learned from my mother, you know, those ways will disappear too, right? Thankfully. So the mindfulness of mind is really mindfulness of mental formations. Both of the wholesome and the unwholesome. I've only really touched on the unwholesome because, you know, there's our threat detection system, right? I need to warn you, right? I'm just remembering an interesting thing about, I went to my first retreat in the Eastern Townships, and it was in French. And they were very kind. They had, I had a personal translator who would sit and whisper in in English in my ear. My French was good, is good to some degree, but when you get into the more, you know, advanced ways of expressing things, I kind of get lost. So I had a personal translator, and so it was in French and Vietnamese, and so so all the talks were personally translated by this little whispering voice beside me. And then they called an emergency meeting, and they spoke in both English and French, so I didn't have a translator. But there had been a bear spotted in the campground near the meditation hall. And so they wanted everyone to know who was camping, and I wasn't. I was in the building. Everyone who was camping to know that there was a bear available. And nobody translated that for me. I kind of figured out based on the word bear and based on the word be careful. Right? So I thought, oh, I guess there's a bear out there and they want me to be careful. Right? But no one translated that for me. I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Within the Buddhist community, being eaten by a bear is not nearly considered as dangerous as not really learning what the teachings of the Buddha are. Because they were much more concerned that I actually understood what the teachings were than whether or not I got eaten by a bear, right? So I think in some sense we have to take that philosophy as well. There are many things we don't need to worry about. Your likelihood of being eaten by a bear is not very high. However, the likelihood of being consumed by your mental formations is extremely high. So that's our practice for today, is to look at these mental formations, to look at what our critical voice is saying, to observe that, to hear it, to turn down the volume, learn how to turn down the volume, to begin to encourage other mental formations that are focused on soothing and calming. Not because we want to avoid this other stuff. I mean, we do still have to do the work around that. But because we can't do the work around the unwholesome mental formations until we're steady. Until I'm the flagpole, I can't even consider how to deal with this flapping flag. Right. So it's really important, this first part of breathing, the long breath, short breath, the body, the way the body is conditioned by the breath, very crucial for our physiology. Now, how the breath is connected to those mental formations, how we get on those trains that pull into our station, that's what we're turning towards now. Okay, and it may be a bit of a wild ride, but recognize the mental formations are just that. They're fabrications. They're mind tricks. They're well-intended. They're intended to keep us safe. But some of them may not be working anymore. Some of them may be keeping us safe from things that are dangerous or are long gone. And some of them may be alerting us, but yelling at us so that we don't really hear them in a way we need to. Right? So we're letting you play in your forebrain for today. Don't get lost. And if, you know, things get a little bit upregulated, come back to the breath. That's your anchor. Come back to the breath. And explore. How true is this? You know, a self-concept is really just a hypothesis. It's just a suggestion that you can go test out. I would like to read a poem, if you will indulge me. But those of you who have taken a mindfulness program, you know this well. Looks like the internet is not going to cooperate. Oh, sorry about that. This evening, in our evening talk, I'd like to expand some of what I've said into pain management and physical pain management, because that also creates a number of mental formations that are, you know, not necessarily wholesome.